morning. Can you speak for a minute?
Yes, I certainly can. I'm Lisa Hillman. We're here in Orleans, and I am interviewing, and he'll introduce himself.
Aquí estoy, Phil Albers Jr., Nakaru Kuara.
And Phil, do you agree that we are recording this audio, both audio and visually, and do you agree to let this information be published?
Huh.
Which means yes, in English. Okay, thank you so much, Phil, and we're very happy that you've agreed to share with us a photograph. And I see you've brought the photograph with you, and perhaps you'd like to just begin by telling us a little bit about the photograph.
Ah, yeshi. Payom panani picture kusripan. This is my picture of a madrone tree, and it's very special to me. As you can see, the picture has gotten stuck to the frame. I took this picture before I had any children, so it is minimum 12 years old. I think it's the only one that I've had that long in a frame. but it has a lot of meaning to me on so many levels because, it's a beautiful tree anyways. It was in the springtime and the almost summer, and the bark is starting to peel off. So the madrone, that deep reddish brown color, was on the outer layer, and it's peeling off. And you can see some of the green and the new growth underneath coming out as it's getting bigger and growing. And so this tree, this picture was taken on my grandmother's properties, on her home property. So to get an idea, it's on the Klamath River, and it's across the river from where Stanshaw Creek comes into the Klamath. And there's the river, and then there's the river bar, and then as you keep moving up the hill away from the river, there's a big meadow. And it's a field. We call it a meadow, but it's a field of grass. And awesomely enough, it has not been overrun at all by briars. So it's all pretty, I guess you could say natural. But so then this meadow, then when you get to the edge of the meadow and you start getting into a tree line, it's almost all oak and madrone for couple hundred feet before it gets into steeper territory and then into firs, into a thicker, denser forest. So it was like a perfect playground for me when I was a kid to be able to go from the river, run up through into the meadow, and then go into this open tree little forest stand, I guess you could say. And so anyways, knowing where that is, and knowing that I said it's my grandmother's property, that's where we spent a lot of free time during the summer. And even on different holidays, like Easter vacation or whatever, the water was typically too high to cross, but sometimes we were able to do it, and we'd go over there. But so my grandmother was Lucille Albers, and she was one of the last of the few full-blooded first language speakers. And so it was pretty amazing to be able to just go over there and when she could still walk around and move around. And you know, back then when I took this picture, she didn't need any help. She packed all of her own stuff in, and anything she took in, she took out. She never would leave trash or anything. And the only way to access it is either crossing the river and then hiking up the trail, which is probably, I don't know, maybe a little over a quarter mile, or driving up on the road and going from Dillon Creek and driving on that road towards Orleans and then hiking the mile and a half or 2 miles down, which there was no trail for that. That would lead directly to the house.
I want to ask just a clarification. When you were talking about briars, are you speaking mainly to the Himalayan blackberry, the noxious weeds?
Right, right.
And so are would you, do you imagine that this land so is a little bit more naturally resilient towards those invasive weeds because of its, because it's so its natural way of keeping those madrones and oak?
I think there are a lot of factors there. One of the bigger ones is it's I guess you could say it has far less foot traffic by people, humans. But yes, I'm referring to those blackberries that just take over everything, and the ones that you were talking about. Now, what's weird about it is where, and this is kind of interesting. I never really thought about it until now, but so the house is up on the hill a little ways. And the village, the traditional village site, is called Ishiram Hirak, which is the place of the sulfur springs. And it's within a short distance, and I guess short is relative. In the old days, it was a short distance. Nowadays, it's a little more, maybe a mile or two, from Johnson's, across from Irving Creek. So there was a trail that you could easily run. I mean, my aunties and some of my other family say they would just run down there, and they would just run, like no big deal. And now I'm like, I don't even know where I could even go, and it's all grown over. But and it seems like a long ways to me, but to them it was no big deal, and they just ran it several times a day, going back and forth between those homesteads, I guess they were at that time.
Right, I know that you had talked about having Bud Johnson, who's a Karuk elder, and his family's home is, like you said, just on the same side of the river, and they used to travel across the river in a boat. So would they have been doing the same thing? So with your family as well?
Yeah. So in the old time or the older days, my grandmother has there's recordings that have been done by different programs, and the food security program with the Karuk tribe was one of them, where she talked about when the miners were there and how that changed the river and how that changed things. Well, on that property, I'll back up a little bit. Her family, she was born there, and her family raised her there. So all summer long, they had a huge, huge meadow. I mean, garden. And it was next to the meadow. It wasn't actually in the same place of the meadow where I'm talking about. Now, that garden has completely overgrown with those blackberries, that weed, that noxious weed blackberry. And in order to take the old trail to the house, that's the shorter route, you have to cut through those every year, and they grow back. I mean, it's huge patches that would fill up this whole building. And so I think, like you're saying, when I look at that, and I know the blackberries can live there, they do, I think it does have to do with the natural environment of why it's a little more resilient and why they haven't gotten into that field. Because, I mean, it's literally 20 to 30 feet from this huge patch where you have to use a chainsaw or be really good with a machete to get through it.
Right.
Of blackberries, so thick, and it's not just a little ways. I mean, it's a huge, this garden that they used to have was huge, and she would talk about they would get up before the sun came up and work till a certain hour, and then during the heat of the day, all the kids could go play, and they'd have all their fun and do whatever they do, and then when it started to cool off and the sun started to drop, they'd have to go back and work.
In the garden that you're talking about, are you, is that, do you think that there were also cultural resources that were also cultivated in the garden, or
Yeah, and we've spent a lot of time. Well, not as much now as I would have liked, but we did spend time walking through there and looking at so many of the different natural resources there, like the teas and a lot of the herbs that I didn't quite understand very well then when I was really young, and so it's all vaguely there, but it's not really anything I can grab a hold of, but I know there was some there. But then as I got older and I started to ask more questions, we were able to, like, gooseberries and huckleberries and not a whole lot of huckleberries, but you're able to find acorns was one of the biggest ones. But my gram said, oh, we don't eat these acorns. we go way up the hill and get, we only get acorns from up high. And that was her preference. But I'll just take any acorns I can get them.
You bet.
But one of the cool things was, and that's always one of my favorite things, is the whatever that weed is that you can make gum out of.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Milkweed or whatever it's called.
But I
know what it looks like, but I don't know what it's called. But you can just cut the top off and then put it on a hot rock and it'll make gum. And it has no flavor, but I mean, it's just weird to me. There are so many other things. You can't just grab that and eat it. You know, there are these steps you have to do and these things you need to do. And my grandma was pretty accurate about explaining this is how her family did it, as opposed to this is how the whole people, or you have to do it or you're bad or whatever, you know. She did well to explain that to us. And so all of that stuff. Now, going back to the boating, before I was born, well, when my grandmother was little, they had that house, which was they lived in the summertime. But in the wintertime, when the river gets high and it's not safe to cross, and she did have school and such, they would have a house on the other side, on this side that was actually closer to the actual creek. And so they would stay in that house during the winter months and then go back over.
We've got just 5 more minutes, so I'd like to. So there's 2 things. I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about the cultural significance of the madrone tree, and since I know you to be a very gifted storyteller, that mm-hmm. might be something that you might want to do. But the time is yours. You can decide what you'd like to do.
Yeah, madrone has a lot of cultural significance, not only just in what you can get from the madrone tree as far as the berries and different things. But my gram said, and this, I just want to, how the madrone grows and it peels off like that, and that bark, it's not like what you would think of in a tree bark. She said, this was our paper. And she said, even in the old days when they didn't write words and letters, they could demonstrate what they wanted to by having a simple burnt-in stick and marking on that paper. And she would talk about her dad and her family, her uncles, showing her some of that stuff and how they would demonstrate that because, they were old Kadook speakers. They didn't really do English and they didn't know how to read or write. And then when we started to learn that stuff, then we would make notes on it and hide it, make it our little treasure hunt game or whatever, and she had a lot of fun with it. But as far as the madrone goes, there is more than one story. I don't know. That I majored in health. I always say that. there are stories that talk about the madrone and how that plays in helping to create some of the environment that we are surrounded in here. So that's pretty neat, and the one that stands out the most is madrone berries, which are really good. I like them. And that's how red breast became the red-breasted robin, how he got his red chest. That's a pretty fun story, and I've heard a lot of different versions of that, all the way from Klamath up, and I've heard a version in Hoopaw also. So that's pretty fun. As far as the madrone and how the madrone fits in with the ecosystem and what that tree provides on a year-round basis, there's a lot that could be learned there.
Particular, perhaps firewood might talk about when you use madrone wood or its preference in cooking or in the sweat house or
and my gram would always prefer madrone over everything else as a firewood for her wood stove in her house, and she had one of those stoves that you could cook on, So when we were camping, I was like, well, fir will burn faster, and it, but nope, she would always prefer Madrone. And she would always explain that seasoned Madrone will burn hotter for longer than any other wood. And I mean, I have no reason to doubt that. I'm not as picky. I'll just burn whatever. So, Madrone is also used for a lot of things. I know that there's stories, and I've done it myself. I've made spoons and different tools out of Madrone because of its durability. I mean, when you season it the best, I have even heard of some people using that for paddles. And I mean, like an actual paddle for their canoe. I don't know. I've never seen one, but I've heard that. So well, I mean, there are a lot of uses.
Right. Well, I'm sorry for gull, but thank you very much. If there's anything more that you'd like to tell, tell our and perhaps you'll hold up the photograph so that people can see it. Yeah. The video takers. If there's something more you'd like to say. About Madrone and some Madrone leaves, or also this particular place. It's been wonderful that you've shared this with us.
Yeah, mostly I just like to say this tree really is one of the things, and the Madrone tree in general, it really ties me emotionally and mentally to my grandmother and to our place and our time together, And so that's why I've always held it so dear. My grandmother and I were very, very close, and she wouldn't even talk to me in the language until I had put in about 4 years of language, and she said, okay, now you don't sound like a baby, so I'll talk to you. And then we actually started working together and did some recordings, and she was never really harsh, but just very like, no, you're not. And I think there was validity in there. It kind of helped me understand that speaking language isn't just making sounds that will work. It's about actually effectively communicating what you're thinking and feeling and what you want to express. And in order to do that accurately within any given language, there needs to be that full commitment and that full buy-in. And so anyways, whenever I see Madrone trees or I'm out around them, I feel like I'm around my gram. And that's just one of the things that I really hold on to for tying us together.
And I'm trying to say thank you for your thoughts. So Phil, is there something in this interview that you would prefer that isn't put into the public domain?
No, I think everything's pretty safe.
Yotwa.
Okay.